Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Emerging market stocks have become eye-catchingly cheap, trading at price-earnings ratios that are historically very far below those of markets in the developed world. But with weak global trade and China's slowdown, are they the sort of investment bargains that are best left in the bin? On today's Money Show, we have an emerging market special. We've gathered a group of the world's most respected writers and commentators on these markets to explore whether retail investors should go where many of the world's professional money managers fear to tread. And for those that are brave enough, we've also called in a wealth management expert to discuss where emerging markets should fit in a balanced portfolio. Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's most popular weekly podcast. I'm Naomi Rovnik, digital editor of FT Money, and I'll be giving you all the week's money news in downloadable form with the help of my FT colleagues, James King and Jonathan Wheatley, plus special studio guest Liam Halligan, the economist and strategist who began his career here at the FT. We also have with us the FT Money columnist and personal finance expert Jason Butler. So, remember BRICS? We don't mean the building blocks, but that popular investment phrase coined by economist and now government minister Jim O'Neill and standing for Brazil, Russia, India and China. It used to hit the front page of FT Money quite a lot in 2010. That was a year when fund houses rushed to launch products to satisfy a huge appetite for investing in the BRIC countries. Fast forward to today and the term has dropped off the news pages after the investment case for these markets crumbled in the face of China's slowdown, a commodities rout. Warren Buffett said, however, that we should be greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy. Unloved emerging markets are now looking cheap, which could be for a very good reason. I'm first going to turn to James King to discuss this. James is the FT's emerging markets editor and one of our foremost China experts. He's not only a Mandarin speaker and the author of several books on China, he's a veteran of reporting on Asia, having covered events from Tiananmen Square to Japanese deflation. James, in a nutshell, why is the Chinese economy slowing down and what effect is this having on other emerging markets?
Well, I think when you strip all the noise away, China's problem is pretty simple. There is an investment drought. The return on investments for local governments and for companies is really very meager in almost all sectors right now. So what we've seen is that last year, fixed asset investment fell to its lowest level in many years. This has a big impact on the emerging world because China consumes more than half of the industrial commodities produced by the world, and most of those come from emerging markets. So Capital Economics estimates that the value of resource imports, commodity imports from the rest of the world to China last year was down about 50% from its highs in 2014. This, of course, affects economies from Africa to Latin America and in other parts of the world. But it's not all negative because there are some green shoots that are beginning to show through right now. Real estate sales are beginning to pick up, so the demand for materials used in construction should also follow. The Chinese government unleashed a massive credit splurge in January, record numbers of new loans and bond issuances. So that should mean that Chinese investment might pick up sooner or later.
So are you saying, James, that China's not just slowing down exponentially, but maybe also is is rebalancing, that word that economists love to use?
I'm not really sure that it's rebalancing. I think what's happening is that the Chinese government is starting to revert to its old reflexes of pushing investment and trying to resuscitate the real estate market again.
So that will lead to further imbalances in the future?
Probably will, but at the same time, consumer spending is holding up. So I think we just have to keep a bit of a working brief on that.
And markets seem to want stimulus, don't they? I mean, short-term investors seem to cheer each time the Beijing government applies stimulus. Perhaps it is steroids, perhaps it's a sticking plaster, perhaps it's storing up problems for the future. Do you think it's better if Beijing doesn't do that, lets things slow down on their own?
Personally, I think the situation in China is so severe, given the debt load and given, as I mentioned, the investment drought, that if they didn't do it, the probability of a Chinese hard landing is really there. And I think that's why they've taken these measures to unleash the credit taps,
so
as we saw
trapped.
In January.
And you've talked about commodities, but what about other emerging markets that could perhaps decouple from China? Perhaps they're transformers of commodities instead of producers. I'm thinking of South Korea, Taiwan, etc. Could they go off on their own?
Well, there is a movement within the markets these days, the so-called TICS countries. So that is Taiwan, India, China and South Korea. And these do tend to be tech-focused countries that are not dependent on commodity exports. And I do believe that they are relatively insulated to the emerging market slowdown that we see at the moment.
So TICS, not BRICS. Thank you, James. We're also joined by James's colleague, Jonathan Wheatley. He's one of the FT's most senior Latin America experts, and he's editor of our emerging markets service, EM Squared. Jonathan, you've spotted that some fund managers, for example BlackRock, are saying there's value in emerging market investments. This comes although Brazil and Russia have slipped into recession, emerging market currencies have fallen heavily against the dollar. Do you think we're really at a turning point now where EM stocks, corporate credit, currencies could recover as the world's financial experts perhaps just collectively decide there's been too much pain?
Well, BlackRock are not alone. I mean, BlackRock, as you know, the biggest fund manager in the world, have taken a view that it is time to start stocking up on EM corporate credit, which is a bold view in the views of a lot of people. But they're not alone.
This would be the bonds issued by
the bonds issued by emerging market companies in their own currencies. We've seen, I mean, there's dedicated EM investors like Ashmore and Fidelity have been saying the same kind of thing over the last few days, that either get into EM bonds, even get into EM equities. I have to say, I mean, BlackRock itself doesn't necessarily have a huge amount of skin in the game. They're not, and that they're not a dedicated investor. The others, you would expect to say that.
They have not got anything else to sell. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. BlackRock have a case. I mean, they say that the dollar has stopped appreciating against EM currencies. They say that that means that you'll stop being hit by the dollar. You'll be able to get the spread that EM corporate credit gives you over developed market corporate credit, because that won't be blown away by currency depreciation. And they believe that turbulence on the oil market is nearing an end, because now you've got...
good for Brazil, good for Russia.
It's good for them, but turbulent oil markets have been bad for everybody, really. So even if you benefit from a low oil price, the uncertainty about the oil price has been destabilizing.
Now, back to those ticks.
Yeah.
One fund manager I spoke to recently has put 10% of his rather large fund in Indonesia, which seems a bit out there. But his point is that Indonesia is a big consumer of oil. So as the oil price stays cheap, perhaps this is good for consumer spending.
Well, yes, indeed, perhaps it is. And there's plenty of other places around the world that you can say, look, this country, India, has a big reform program. Mexico has a reform program. There are reasons to be optimistic all around the place if you look. And in fact, if you look in sectors, there are plenty of companies that are doing really quite well. But this is all a bit sort of down among the data. If you step back and say, what is the EM story? Why do people buy EM assets? It's because emerging markets emerge and their economies grow more quickly than developed market
economies.
And
now they're not?
Now they're not. I think if you take out China out of the mix, they are now growing more slowly than developed markets. And they may make up a massive proportion of the world's GDP, but if that share isn't growing as quickly as the rest, then, you know, where's the story?
So from faster and more risky, we've gone to slower and more risky.
And the problem is that the emerging market companies are much more in debt and their earnings are coming down. They are less attractive from those two points of view than DM companies.
So it feels like we've had the party and now it's really been a long hangover.
I think a lot of people would say that EM's time will come again, but there's an awful lot of pain to go through before that, and there's a lot of very, very difficult reform to be done.
Thank you, Jonathan. Finally, Liam Halligan, you're both an economist and a prolific commentator and broadcaster, and I hope I'm right in summarising that you've spent much of your career observing events in Russia and around the former Soviet Union. One of the roles in your current portfolio involves working with Jerome Booth, an investor and author who believes emerging markets are more important than many investors realise. Do you share that sense of bullishness? And if so, which emerging markets do you think retail investors should put their money into for the long term?
Yeah, I do share that sense of bullishness. The emerging markets are, of course, three quarters of humanity now, four fifths of the world's foreign exchange reserves, and well over half of GDP and rising. Of course, there's an awful lot of volatility because the equity markets of emerging markets often in recent years a derivative of what Ben Bernanke or Janet Yellen have just said, or even Mario Draghi or Mark Carney. These markets expressed in dollars and printed in the Financial Times very much at the whim at the moment of Western monetary policy. But if you're a direct investor, if you're a big multinational company, you are often very, very heavily invested in these markets. Of course, those kind of investments are difficult for retail investors to get exposure to, at least without suffering very, very punitive fees. But are the emerging markets increasingly important in the world economy? Absolutely, of course they are. They're not going anywhere.
And turning to Russia, is it currently too unstable and volatile for anyone but the experts to invest in, or will it be a long-term success story?
Well, of course, the Russian economy contracted last year by about 3%. This year, there's a wide range of estimates of what will happen from plus 3% if you're Sparebank to minus 3% if you're most London-based investors. Of course, again, that's a dollar GDP figure. Mm. It goes back to this sort of massive macro, global macro currency overlay when you're looking at any emerging market. A lot of the headline dollar GDP number and therefore the equity index number, whether it's the locally denominated MICEX or the dollar denominated RTS, will of course depend on the oil price. My theory, I sound like Anne Elk out of Monty Python for older listeners. My theory is that the best thing that could happen for Russia now in terms of the oil price is a short, sharp shock. If we dip right down decisively below $25 for a few months, knock out some of the shale producers, knock out some of the, in my view, rather overblown estimates of what Iran's going to do on the oil front over the next 6 to 12 months, then you could see the geopolitical stars aligning, a proper Saudi-Russia deal rather than the hints at a deal we've had so far, and a realignment of oil north of 40, which I think almost everybody would agree that's where the fundamentals should be. Oil hasn't got easier to find or extract. It's not as if the emerging markets have stopped demanding. Demand isn't falling. The demand is just growing less quickly in places like China.
Well, we're almost out of time. And there's one final question. It's a really difficult one. I'm going to give it to the whole panel. I'm going to give each of you 30 seconds to answer it. What effect does the monetary policy of developed world central banks have on how emerging market stocks perform? I'm going to put that to James first. Off you go.
I get the least time to prepare. So developed market quantitative easing has sent enormous amounts of money into the developing world. This has exacerbated situations of overcapacity, which exist particularly in places like China, which has brought deflation to several emerging markets. And that deflationary wind has had huge effects in emerging markets and also in developed markets.
Liam, do you want to give us 30 seconds?
I think we will get a lot more QE in the West. I've been writing that for many years. I used to be laughed at. Now I'm not. Mark Carney's just said there could easily be more QE in the UK. If we do get more QE, it will be because the markets are in a really bad place. And of course, that will be bad for the emerging markets. I think it's right that, of course, the boom we had in emerging markets was largely because of risk on money trying to find a higher yielding home. And now that's gone.
Okay, and Jonathan, your 30 seconds, please.
I agree. I think we will get more QE. I think the problems that it was designed to deal with have not gone away. I think it's exacerbated them, in fact. The stock of debt has gone up, while any attempt to deal with that stock has been delayed by the magic powers of QE. I think it's driven up a huge amount of debt in emerging markets, and it's driven down the profitability of those borrowers. So it's sent debt up, earnings down, and it's been noxious.
Thank you so much. And thanks for our panel for that insightful discussion. Before our final item, a reminder that you can read this week's FT Money as part of the weekend FT, which is widely available on both Saturday and Sunday, or read online at ft.com/money, or follow us on Twitter at FT Money. Now we've heard views on emerging markets from those expert journalists and economists, it's time to talk about the practicalities of investing in this asset class. I'm joined in the studio now by Jason Butler, the FT Money columnist and independent personal finance expert, who formerly ran Bloomsbury Wealth Management before he headed off into the sunset to write and to educate kids about personal finance. Jason, what's your view on investing in emerging markets? Are they best left to the very brave with a lot of capital to risk, or should they be a core part of anyone's ISA or SIP?
No, I think they should be an essential element of the equity component of anyone's portfolio.
And why is that?
Well, because if you think about it, emerging economies, there's no real consensus as to what they are really. There's different definitions. But let's just consider they're countries generally that have undeveloped capital markets. They have normally fast-growing populations, large amounts of young people. They can be natural resource heavy, etc. So you would expect them to experience higher levels of economic growth.
Although they haven't been in recent years.
Well, they may not have been in recent years, but you know, it's like measuring the place from your home to your office with a 6-inch ruler. If we think about the trends that are happening, there's a massive amount of emerging middle classes in India, Turkey, China, etc. Now, notwithstanding the current issues and problems which all economies go through as they grow, you've got to say to yourself, if you've got a 30 to 60 year time horizon, which most people have, does it make sense to have an allocation to those faster growing economies? They don't come with extra returns without extra risk.
And they tend to kind of go in and out like concertinas, don't they? The banks lend and lend, the economy grows really fast, and then there's some kind of financial crisis normally.
Yeah, yeah.
Things contract and then they go out again.
Well, it's just what you have is you have more speculation in these markets. And essentially, because people are wanting to invest in the next best thing, or they overcommit their funds in the world's full of hope, and then they sort of head for the hills when the world turns a bit black.
And when you don't have large domestic stock markets, that those inflows and outflows can make a huge difference. Now, what's the best way, however, to own emerging markets?
Well,
should you pick stocks yourself?
No. I mean,
should you pay an expensive expert to pick them for you?
No, not at all. The simplest way to own emerging markets is to have a fully diversified index fund. The evidence shows that there's no extra likelihood of an active manager outperforming the index. And the index fund itself is not perfect, okay, because it doesn't represent the full economic activity that's going on, because these markets don't reflect all of the economic activity. So in other words, what you can invest in is not the same as what's going on in those countries. So I think an index fund of a globally diversified emerging markets exposure for something between 10 to 30% of your equity element. So, for instance, if you've got 50% equity allocation, then that's somewhere between 5 to 15% perhaps.
Great, thank you. That was Jason Butler, and you can read his latest column in FT Money this Saturday. We'd love to know what you think about investing in emerging markets and asset allocation and money matters more generally. You can get in touch via email. The address is money@ft.com. You can tweet us at FTMoney, and you can leave comments at the foot of individual articles on our website. Additionally, if you have a financial conundrum you'd like us to help you solve, email us and we'll consider it for our Your Questions section. There's just time to tell you what else will feature in this week's issue. Our resident millennial FT writer Amy Williams is writing on the traps landlords lay for young renters. We also cover the fallout from the government's decision to raise the fees charged for probate and the risks of the growing market for investments called mini bonds. The Money Show was produced and edited in London by Adam Palin. We'll be back next week, but now it's goodbye from me and our studio guests.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost £27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.